Hello, my name is Anthony Patch, and this is another edition of Pulse. This is the 25th of February of 2025. The title is Pulse Expectations, U.S., Ukraine, and Russia. The central focus from which I will present my expectations of the very near future events to unfold are centered upon the discussion and somewhat the controversy related to the natural resources within Ukraine itself. Specifically, you've heard this described as the minerals, the mineral rights, the rare earth metals, the lithium, and so forth and so on. But this also includes the categories of oil and natural gas, and predominantly something that has really hurt the U.S. agriculture sector, the farmers, as well as others in other Western nations, is fertilizer. Fertilizer in the form of nitrates and ammonia that are mined, that are gathered out of Ukraine, and sent by bulk carrier ships to the United States and then transported by train to farmers all over the United States. And when the U.S. imposed sanctions upon Russia, we were cut off from access to fertilizer from Ukraine because of the military conflict going on, as well as fertilizer from Russia itself. And these were relatively inexpensive sources of bulk fertilizers. So that does not get enough attention in the media when they talk about minerals or natural resources in Ukraine. So I'd like to provide that as a central focus to begin to talk about the conflict in Ukraine and negotiations between President Trump and Vladimir Putin, which I do not expect to be including in those discussions Zelensky from Ukraine. I consider him, and I think they do, consider him now as irrelevant. And legally speaking, in the international sector of international law, he is not recognized as the legal elected or appointed or selected leader of Ukraine. And therefore, legally speaking, he has no voice for the people of Ukraine. So we've been hearing in the media a lot about a ceasefire and even a peace treaty to be negotiated between Trump and Putin. And I'll just make it brief in terms of their labels, their titles. I'm expecting that, let's just call this a peace treaty, that perhaps simultaneous or very soon thereafter the signing of a peace treaty, there will be the lifting of sanctions by President Trump that were placed upon Russia. Again, we all understand, you know, the art of the deal, Trump is a businessman, all those good things. So if we look at it through the lens that President Trump views negotiations with Russia in general, with Putin, his counterpart, both of them are businessmen. Now, a lot can be said about the background of Putin, and we won't go into that. But essentially, if we take BRICS, which we will go into in a few moments, when we look at BRICS as the lens, the paradigm by which Putin has been operating, he is a businessman. So we have business negotiations that are going to take place. These are not military negotiations. And even in the alternative media, even in the so-called conservative media, the claim has been put forth that President Trump has been left with really no levers, no points of leverage entering into negotiations with Putin from which he can extract concessions from Putin as part of the negotiations for a peace treaty. And yet that's not entirely correct. those statements are not including what I started with as a central focus here today, and not including the leverage of natural resources. Obviously, the territory, the country of Ukraine has been divided roughly 50-50. Russia occupying the Donbass, Petrovsk, and regions such as that. Roughly half of the eastern portion of Ukraine is under Russian control. And it will remain so, even with a peace treaty being signed. It will be maintained, it will be controlled, it will be annexed as part of the Russian Federation going forward. That's for security reasons, that's the fruits of war, the fruits of go to the victor, the spoils of war go to the victor, and so forth and so on. So that's not going to be disputed by Trump. We have to recognize that the largest deposits of natural resources, specifically the so-called rare earth metals, which even the U.S. and many countries possess their own vast quantities of so-called rare earth metals. They're only rare because they are few in quantity and number, but it requires a great deal of investment in the extraction of these rare earth metals, the sifting, the sorting, and the refining, and then the transport for use of these metals is very expensive. So both in quantity, they're rare, but also the cost to extract makes them rare as well. The United States could obtain their own rare earth metals from the U.S., continental U.S., if we chose to do that. But nonetheless, we're focused on Ukraine. Russia has the bulk of the deposits in the Donbass region, which was early on in 2021 annexed by Russia. Without getting into the politics of that issue, we're talking resources. So Russia already has those resources, but those resources need to be developed, and that costs money. And this is where the United States has its primary point of leverage, not just with Russia, but with BRICS nations and all nations, really. Because most, if not all, countries receive some form, some quantity of foreign aid, money from the United States. We've seen the revelations coming out through DOGE, the USAID, and all of that foreign aid that's gone out and various programs. Again, without getting into the politics, we need to understand that the big lever that Trump can pull is foreign aid, money that is sent to other countries. So when President Trump says, well, we will not send money to BRICS nations. Now, Russia has received money from the U.S. in the past for the development of its natural resources and dealing with its nuclear programs, both domestic and military, such as radiation, radioactive contamination cleanup and demilitarization and so forth over the years. So without getting into the weeds, the point here is that even Russia, not so much in the form of foreign aid at the present time, but Russia wants access to our capital, to our deep pockets, both in the form of government deep pockets, but also the deep pockets of the private sector through venture capital and general stock market investments, private sector investment in Russia, which Russia enjoyed for many, many years since the fall of the Soviet Union. The Russian Federation was formed, the Federation of States was formed principally to develop foreign trade, which included the United States. So the way that Putin views this for Russia is we want to open up the resources in the eastern portion of Ukraine to Western, if not global, but principally Western trade. Russia holding those resources, those minerals, etc., requires a great deal of capital investment on the part of Russia to leverage, to take advantage, to engage in trade in those natural resources. This is something that the private sector and the federal government in the United States can cooperate with Russia, bringing financial capital to that eastern portion of Ukraine for the extraction and market sale of those natural resources. You can say exactly the same thing with the Western-controlled portion of Ukraine and the resources therein. Again, Western capital, this would include Europe, but principally in the negotiation for peace, it will be the United States and Russia, recognizing that capital investment is the pathway going forward that is provided by the West. Now, Europe, from its part, Europe is nearly bankrupt. Most of the countries in Europe, Western Europe in particular. This leaves the United States as the source of that financial investment. And of course, through the paradigm, through the lens of business, through trade, this is something that Putin wants access to. This is the primary point of leverage going into these negotiations that can be exercised by Trump. Thus, the peace treaty, I think the discussion will center not so much on the ceasing of hostilities, the demilitarization, the denazification, which have been the principal points demanded by Putin to bring an end to the conflict, but not only those, but also the neutrality of Ukraine will be established in these negotiations, much like the Austrian model of neutrality. But any discussion regarding Ukraine joining as a member of NATO will not even be a point of discussion. NATO, Trump has threatened to pull funding. Again, that's the lever, funding with NATO, threatened to pull funding from NATO and thus pull the United States out of NATO. And thus NATO becomes irrelevant, and therefore membership and a discussion of membership of Ukraine in NATO becomes irrelevant. Anyway, we're talking about going forward. We're talking about expectations. So let's stay on point with that. The financial aspect of this, in terms of, let's review what I've said. Investment of capital by the West in Ukraine and in the Russian-controlled areas of Ukraine. So all of the Ukraine and former Ukraine areas. Investment for the development of natural resources benefits Russia, benefits the West. We have to then begin to look at what will Ukraine receive, the people of Ukraine receive by this development of the resources. Well, obviously money is brought in, not only in the mining and refining and transport infrastructure, but rebuilding Ukraine itself, its towns, its cities, its energy production, and so forth and so on. Western capital will come in to do that. Western businesses will come in to do that. This principally will be paid for by these natural resources. President Trump has already made it very clear to Putin that the U.S. has provided $500 billion so far to Ukraine by way of this conflict. And thus, Trump wants a return on that investment in Ukraine. So a lot of the royalties, let's not speak in terms of profits because that's too far into the weeds, but just think in terms of royalties from those natural resources. Those royalties partly will go to the United States so that we recoup that investment of $500 billion But it will also divide those royalties, and those will be sent to the Ukrainian people in the form of rebuilding their country. Okay? So the Ukrainians are not necessarily going to be taken advantage of. There's not going to be a theft of natural resources. This is a business relationship between the West, the United States in particular, Ukraine, and Russia. This will be a three-party agreement, this peace treaty, because the peace treaty is a business contract. Okay? So the sanctions will be lifted, as I said earlier. A royalty agreement will be signed. Pardon me. The rebuilding of the western portion of Ukraine, excuse me, but not exclusively. This will include the eastern portion, the Russian-controlled portion, will be developed cooperatively by Russian businesses and businesses from the West. Now, this sounds to be at odds with the formation of BRICS by Russia and Brazil, India, China, South Africa. So, and there are now more member nations, but BRICS is going to dissolve as a result of what is being negotiated in Ukraine. This business contract / treaty, peace agreement, really will result in the disbanding of BRICS. The necessity for BRICS is being removed. Again, the business necessity for BRICS, not so much a military like a NATO agreement, but a business agreement between these member nations is going away. It is partly the result of what has happened and is about to happen with Ukraine, with the lifting of sanctions and so forth and so on, the rebuilding. But we have to go back to the primary lever by Trump going into the negotiations with Putin, which is financial. The United States still has deep pockets. Partly this is the recouping of monies that have been fraudulently distributed around the world by USAID and other agencies of the U.S. government. This whole DOGE process is resulting in dramatic multiple billions of dollar reductions in expenditures by the U.S. government. And these expenditures, these savings, can be redirected in terms of foreign aid, properly managed foreign aid, better categorized and characterized as investment, foreign investment. Again, the paradigm of business. Rather than just giving money to countries, the U.S. will engage in investment in countries. And this is what BRICS has been all about. It's been about the ability to engage in cross-border trade, utilizing central bank digital currencies, each sovereign country having its own CBDC that then interfaces with the Bank for International Settlements in the settlement of cross-border trade. Of course, the initial thought and intent was to destroy the U.S. dollar. But now that countries are feeling the effects of foreign aid from the United States being cut off by way of the DOGE program, they realize they cannot, in the immediate, in the near term, really economically survive without this influx of the dollar from the United States into their own countries. BRICS would be cutting off their nose to spite their face. So Trump, 2 weeks ago, declared that BRICS is dead. BRICS is no longer relevant. That the U.S. dollar is strong. It is still the reserve currency for the world. And there's no need for BRICS. In other words, it does not need to be an adversarial relationship between the world and the United States. So how does the dollar maintain its reserve status? How does it strengthen, increase in strength? It is what Donald Trump has already said, and that is drill, baby, drill. The U.S. possesses the largest oil and natural gas deposits on the planet. And that's been well known for over 50 years, surpassing the Middle East and other deposits. It's only because of the green agenda that the U.S. has not been able to tap these reserves. Well, that's over and done with. The tapping of these natural resources within the United States, oil and natural gas, and we have others, as I mentioned, coal, for example, this allows the U.S. to export energy. Domestically, it means that energy, the cost of energy domestically, will plummet dramatically. This reduces inflation. This reduces the government deficit and national debt overall. It reduces the taxation, the rate of taxation for U.S. citizens, for the taxpayers. On average right now, it's about 26% for the average household. Trump has said he's going to reduce that in the near term to 15%. And his goal is to eliminate income tax in the United States and eliminate the Internal Revenue Service, and by way of tariffs, replace that taxation, replace the IRS with the External Revenue Service. Now, the threat of tariffs means that this reduces access to the U.S. domestic market by foreign producers. Now, foreign producers want access, but they don't want the tariffs. So again, like the investment of foreign capital into countries, BRICS countries, Ukraine and Russia and others, rather than foreign aid, but now we're talking about Western investment, U.S. investment, really, into countries, this will reduce tariffs. The more that the U.S. has access to foreign markets for its domestically produced products because of the reshoring, the bringing back of American manufacturing from countries like China, for example, reshoring, bringing back domestically the manufacturing, then results in the ability for the U.S. to export to countries, which then eliminates the necessity for tariffs. Tariffs are only a short-term solution, but really a point of leverage by the president, which eventually will dissolve as the gross domestic product domestically here in the United States, the GDP increases, inflation comes down, disposable income, discretionary spending increases for the U.S. citizenry, and manufacturing ramps up, and then those exports take place. Then tariffs disappear. They're no longer necessary, because then the trade deficit, the imbalance of trade in export and import imbalance with the U.S. dramatically is reduced. So it balances out the trade between countries. So there's no need for this adversarial tariff relationship with other countries. Again, all of this of what I'm saying means that BRICS really is no longer necessary. And it is not necessarily to be viewed as an adversarial, an attack on BRICS as an organization and the member countries, as it is simply a recognition that it is no longer necessary, that the world can cooperate economically rather than through tariffs and destruction of currencies. We now have the movement to digital currencies, as I mentioned, the CBDCs, the structure for individual sovereign countries outside of a BRICS organization, sovereign countries having their own central bank CBDCs. This facilitates cross-border trade. The settlement of trade is done digitally through the Bank for International Settlements, allowing that settlement of trade between digital currencies without currency fluctuations. This is the stabilization of the value of sovereign currencies that then allows near immediate and practically no cost in the settlement of those trades. Settlement is simply saying there are two different currencies and we need to exchange those currencies on the books between the seller and the purchaser. That's all it is. Now, the United States, the Federal Reserve, the central bank for the United States, has a central bank digital currency. Back in 2021, and we published this in our Entangled magazine that we publish every month, we cover economics, science, biology, quantum mechanics, artificial intelligence, politics, all of these things we cover in our monthly Entangled magazine. This can be accessed through anthonypatch.com. We also produce three live streams a week, 2 hours on average, on Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday. Every week, there are almost 900 live streams in the archives and our Entangled magazine dating back to its founding in June of 2017, available in the archives through anthonypatch.com, which is all subscriber supported. Okay? Live streams are subscriber supported, as is the magazine. So if you would like access to that, go to anthonypatch.com, sign up as a subscriber to support our work. And this is our deep research, Kathleen and myself. Kathleen is my wife. Kathleen and I have been for almost 12 years now publishing and speaking and producing all of this information for our subscribers. So it is subscriber-based, the research, and as we like to characterize it, our reporting to our subscribers. Okay? So there's much more than what you see in YouTube and Pulse and all of that. This is just an introduction of what we do. But getting back to what we're talking about here, the CBDCs, the Central Bank of the United States, back in 2021, which we published in Entangled Magazine, the actual definitive proof, okay, facts, that's what we present, that's what we report on, facts, not conjecture, unless we label it as conjecture. The Central Bank of the United States tested and proved that the central bank digital currency of the United States properly works with, interfaces with, the Bank for International Settlements. Thus, the U.S. CBDC already works with the CBDCs of all other countries that have thus far developed their own CBDCs. Not all countries have, but eventually they will. So this notion that the dollar was going to be destroyed, that BRICS was going to push the United States to the point of being isolated from the rest of the world, from a market standpoint, from a trade standpoint, that's all gone. That's been eliminated. So what another expectation is that very soon you are going to hear that the United States is cooperating with other countries. You won't hear the label BRICS, cooperating in trade relations by way of central bank digital currencies through the Bank for International Settlements, and that CBDC of the United States is valued by the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar as a currency will not go away in the near term, because there are still countries that do not yet have the ability to digitally participate in trade through a CBDC. So the dollar as a, let's call it a printed, even though it's zeros and ones, as a printed currency, a sovereign printed currency, it will still exist, but as a transition towards a complete digital economy through CBDCs of all countries, with the expectation that this will then lead to a single digital currency. Call it a CBDC if you will, but it will be a single bank with a single currency under a single global leader. Okay? And we expand upon that in our live streams. I won't do that here. But that's our expectation of where things are going in a longer term time frame. But let's get back to the near term. What does it mean to all of us? Understanding that the U.S. is already cooperating with Russia by way of what I just said, the CBDC through the Bank for International Settlements, which includes all of the BRICS nations, I should say former BRICS nations, which of course includes Russia and China, India, so forth and so on. There is already cooperation on a business level between Trump and Putin. And this is what is not discussed in the media. This is what most pundits or reporters or analysts or whatever that you're seeing out there, they fail to appreciate, fail to fold in and present as I'm trying very succinctly to present to you. But we elaborate in our live streams the details of all of this. So trade relations with Russia already exist. And they exist financially. And therefore, it's not really a point of leverage as it is a point of agreement between Trump and Putin to cease the hostilities in Ukraine. And I think concurrently, do away with the sanctions against Russia. Because it only hurt the West, it hurt the U.S. My example of fertilizer for agriculture, but also the price of fuel, the price of gas and oil, not just to the U.S., but to Europe, in particular, Western Europe, the price of gas, I mean, natural gas, is just extraordinary in its negative impact upon the economies, the financial integrity of those countries. A lot of attention goes to the financial support of Ukraine by Western Europe, but really the bigger negative impact on those economies has been the price of natural gas coming from Russia, okay, and coming from the United States. There was still Russian gas that was being sold through intermediaries, but LNG, liquefied natural gas, coming from the United States, domestic sources for natural gas, by way of ship. These are cargo ships carrying liquefied natural gas to Europe. It's very expensive. Now, that's benefited the U.S. producers, but it hurts our allies in Europe, more so than what the European nations through NATO have contributed to the conflict in Ukraine. So there's going to be immediate financial positive impact, not only for the U.S., and not only for Russia, but also for Ukraine and Western Europe, and really any countries that have been involved in supporting the conflict on the Russian side, which includes North Korea and China. Iran, I should mention Iran supporting Russia in that conflict, and I think I mentioned North Korea, but also on the Ukrainian side, all of those associated countries. The cessation in hostilities, the removal of the necessity to financially support Ukraine in the conflict realizes a positive impact immediately upon the economies of all countries that are involved in this on either side of the conflict. Then you get into the rebuilding of Ukraine and the positive trade relations and positive financial investments. And we need to understand, this isn't just giving money to Ukraine, pumping money again into Ukraine to build their infrastructure. No, this is an investment. And the investment portion of this is the sharing of the natural resources by Russia and its allies and the United States and its allies, all participating in access and development of the natural resources in Ukraine. Ukraine, when it was part of the Russian Federation, I should say the USSR, the Soviet Union, it was the breadbasket for the entire Soviet Union. Its agriculture was the central source of food for all of the Soviet Union. And this, again, was, you know, where the Russian Federation, the modern state of Russia, was really hurt by this separation of Ukraine from the Federation, and really why there needed to be this inclusion of Ukraine in the Russian Federation because they needed access to the farmland and the fertilizers and the production of that food. So Russia is highly motivated to work cooperatively with the West for the financial investment, for the development of everything in Ukraine, which through the development of the resources provides the royalties, as I want to very succinctly call it, those royalties domestically in Ukraine being used to rebuild Ukraine, rather than the negative financial impact upon the Russian state and the Western states having to rebuild what they just destroyed. Okay, so the business lever is what is being pulled here, both by Putin and by Trump, which really can have, it sounds odd, but this can be turned around in Ukraine to be a positive for the rest of the world if it is properly benevolently managed. And therefore, anyone who comes out again about BRICS and says, oh, this is, you know, the West is destroying BRICS, the U.S. is attacking Russia and BRICS nations. You'll hear that, again, an expectation. You'll hear that in the media saying, oh, the West is destroying BRICS. There's a war between the BRICS nations and the West. No. There is none. When Trump says BRICS is irrelevant, it no longer exists, that is not to be taken as the result of an attack. That is not to be taken as a negative. He's simply saying from a business, from a financial standpoint, there's no necessity for BRICS anymore. We can all work together. There's no necessity to destroy the U.S. dollar, to deny its status as a reserve currency for the settlement of cross-border trade. It's not necessary anymore. The nations can cooperate. The nations do not have to be adversarial. In a business relationship, you look at your, not your counterpart, but your trade partner across the desk. You're negotiating a deal. You look at your trade partner as an asset, a possessor of assets, that you would like access to those assets cooperatively. You're not taking something from somebody in a negotiation. You're saying and acknowledging, both parties acknowledging, hey, we each have something that will benefit the other. I have assets that I would like you to have access to. You have assets that I would like access to. Can we enter into a cooperative conversation about how we go about providing both of us access to that which we both possess? What is a fair price for that access? A price that will benefit you and benefit me. We both walk away as winners. You have access at a fair price to the assets that I have, that I'm opening up to you, and likewise you do the same for me. Both parties benefit in the form of profit. Benefit. Benefit to those parties that the two of us as negotiators, as those that are conversing, that are speaking, those people that we represent. How do we benefit the people that we represent? Let's have a cordial conversation as two individuals representing many other individuals. That's really the nub of the issue. That's what it comes down to. You hear this art of the deal and you hear about, oh, you know, points of leverage and we're going to be adversarial. No, you don't enter into a conversation thinking that this is a negotiation between adversaries. The paradigm is not that. The paradigm is we are coming in as friends. We are coming in to cooperate with one another. We come in and we shake hands. Shake hands, the shaking of hands means I have no weapons in my hands. I come in, I'm unarmed, I'm coming in as your friend. Here's my hand. Friendship, symbolized by a handshake. And we sit down, and it's not adversarial. It's not even cooperative, because cooperation implies that there's some point of conflict that needs to be resolved. See, it's a different way of thinking. You're coming in as friends. I want to help you. You want to help me. Let's determine what is the cost that is involved in my gaining access to your assets, and what is the cost for you to gain access to the assets that I'm opening up to you. What's the cost of mining, if we look at minerals? If it's gas and oil, what's the cost of drilling? See, these are the price points. It's not a negotiation. It's just saying, what is it going to cost to access those assets, refine those assets, transport those access to the point in which those assets are being used for manufacturing, for consumption by consumers? How much does that cost? And so we put our costs on the table between, and you say, well, you know, my resources, it looks like it's going to cost this much per ton, per barrel, per gallon, whatever. Okay. And so we look at the market conditions. We look at the market costs. Let's call it the infrastructure cost. That's what's being determined. It's not negotiated. It's being determined. And so both of us, as friends, we say, okay, we both have a picture of the costs involved. Because we understand, it's not even in an agreement of costs. It's just recognition of the costs between two friends. And we say, okay, what's a fair return on our investment in carrying those costs? And we say, hey, why don't we both say a fair return, because we're representing other people. Let's say that a fair return, I'm just going to throw a number out, is 10%. Call that a royalty. A 10% royalty over and above all of the investment cost to access those resources and bring those resources to market. Okay? So now we have two friends that have agreed that 10% royalties. My friend across the table receives 10% royalties. I receive 10% royalties. And I'm not adding 10 and 10 and saying 20%. It's just on those assets, 10% come to me. On the assets that I have that I'm making available, 10% goes to my friend at the table. And it isn't even so much as picturing this as on the other side of the table. That's a wrong paradigm. We're sitting down side by side. Okay, we're not playing cards. We're sitting down side by side, and we're sharing information between the two of us in a cooperative fashion. That's my expectation of the paradigm between Trump and Putin, who represent all those people. Okay? So I'm trying to dispel the notion in the media, in the hysteria, that this is adversarial about anything. Putin is a businessman. I don't care about his background in history. Trump is a businessman. Leaders of nations, if they're smart, if they're wise, they too are businessmen. When I say businessmen, it doesn't mean that they're angels. I'm simply saying that they have the paradigm, the lens of looking at the world through trade. Because that's how the world operates. It's through trade. People talk about money, they talk about gold, they talk about venture capital, they talk about stock markets, they talk about bonds, they talk about the debt-based economy, which I've talked about all of that in our live streams and in our magazine. The world is a debt-based economy. Well, if it is, the WEF, the World Economic Forum, says, well, we need a reset. Well, that's adversarial. And I've talked about this for years, since 2020. I've warned against it. But the threat exists, and it's still there. But Trump, maybe a week after he was inaugurated, was in a video presentation to the WEF that was meeting in Davos, and he said, look, you guys, you're irrelevant. What you're trying to do with your reset, which means collapse the global economy, wipe out all currencies, including the dollar, wipe out all debt, and we're going to restart the global economy. He said, no, you don't need to be destructive. You don't need to be adversarial. You as the WEF and BRICS are irrelevant. And I just explained to you why BRICS is irrelevant. It isn't because Trump is declaring it and therefore it shall be irrelevant. That's not it. He's saying it's the wrong paradigm. WEF with your reset, wrong paradigm. We can do this cooperatively. We can eliminate the debt-based economy not by crashing the economy, but by driving down the debt of all sovereign nations, the global debt. And I know this goes into derivatives and, $4 quadrillion in derivatives, which represent debt. What he's saying is, look, you're doing it the wrong way. Don't be adversarial. Be cooperative, as I just laid out for you. Sit down next to each other at the table, not across from the table. Come in as cooperative friends. Come in and look at the assets. Share the assets. Share the resources. Through cooperative investments with a fair return on the investments, call them royalties. But come in cooperatively. And as we increase the gross domestic product in every nation, not just the U.S., not just Russia, as you increase the standard of living, that's what GDP comes down to, standard of living of your citizens. Then you eliminate debt. You pay down the debt. Trump has said in the near term, he's talked about tariffs. And he goes back to, the late 1800s and early 1900s, the so-called golden age that he's trying to rebuild, the golden age of the U.S., that we had more money coming in by way of tariffs than we knew what to do with, and they formed committees on how to spend the money, and there was no income tax at that time. He's saying that you can pay down the U.S. debt, get rid of the deficit, get rid of the trade imbalance, et cetera, et cetera, through tariffs, but appreciating what I said earlier, that this is a near-term solution to the problem, to increase the GDP, to bring down the inflationary rate, to bring down the cost of borrowing money, interest rates, okay? All of that coming down. Improving the standard of living of each individual population in each sovereign nation pays down the debt. Through trade, through the increase in cooperation, you get rid of debt. The ultimate point, my expectation, if this were to go purely along a benevolent pathway, which is a big stretch, but I'm giving you some near-term expectations with regard to Trump and Putin speaking about not just Ukraine, but cooperation, access to natural resources, rebuilding of Ukraine, but rebuilding the global economies through that starting point in Ukraine, the ripple effect to the global economies in terms of the effect of cooperating, not being adversaries. And I mean that financially, economically, cooperating. Then, through cooperation, which increases trade, which increases the standard of living, pays down the global debt. And now you have an opportunity to shift away from a debt-based economy to a trade-based economy. Trade meaning you access your resources, taking into account the environment, but access the resources of the planet, use your knowledge and technology to leverage those assets, those resources properly, both environmentally responsibly, but economically responsibly. So if you want to talk about supercomputers, and you want to talk about quantum computers, and you want to talk about artificial intelligence, there's another shift in paradigm that can take place. And this goes back to one of the people that I have spoken about for years, but someone who I think really had a good view of the world was R. Buckminster Fuller. Remember the geodesic dome? Buckminster Fuller. He was a polymath, but he said about the world that there has to be a change in thinking, a change from the model of a scarcity model regarding resources of the world, a scarcity model, which is the debt-based economy, to turn that around 180 degrees and say, look, resources are not scarce. It's a matter of how we intelligently use those resources. And again, I'm talking about natural resources, but also the resources of people, their intellect, their imagination, their ability to think. So you don't need AI necessarily, but you can lever AI to help humanity. But at the same time, encourage people to develop their own innate ability to think, their IQ, okay? Buckminster Fuller was saying, look, if we think properly about our resources, we can use our thinking skills, which manifests as technology. We can use our technologies to better utilize the resources on the planet. And because it's defined as a planet, it is finite, and we understand that. But look at the population of the world. It's a little over 8 billion people, which there are a lot, that's a lot of people. But look at the open land, just here in the United States. I've said to our subscribers in the live streams, if you're on a commercial jet flying from the East Coast to the West Coast, there's a great deal of the United States, referred oftentimes to as flyover country, a great deal of open land that is very sparsely populated, just in the United States. And this is true throughout the world. Siberia, okay? Siberia is actually bigger than the continent, the island, of Australia. And Australia is huge. There's a lot of land, a lot of resources that could be developed, properly developed. If we change the model from scarcity to one of abundance. So we're talking about changing paradigms away from adversarial to friendly, cooperative relationships. There's a paradigm. And we go from debt-based paradigm to eliminating the debt through trade, a different paradigm. And we get to that trade by looking at abundance as a new paradigm rather than scarcity. Scarcity results in adversarial relationships, which is the counter to what I'm describing today. So my expectation is, and again, I'm not looking at anybody through rose-colored glasses here. I'm not naive about the world. I'm almost 72 years old. I think I've learned something. But the expectation here in the near term, in the immediate, is that Trump and Putin, as a starting point, as a catalyst for everything that I just described, there is the potential for cooperation. Because I believe the paradigm of Trump and the paradigm of Putin are nearly identical. And I believe their paradigms are what I just shared with you. They're not angels. They're businessmen. But they understand that good business is the result of friendship. It's not even cooperation. It's friendship. It's the shaking of the hand that says, we're not going to shoot at each other anymore. We're not going to bomb each other anymore. What a waste of resources. Let's talk about the resources. You've got assets. I've got assets. Let's put them on the table as two friends that are going to try to help each other. It's like me going to my neighbor across the street here. We live in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. They have vast tracts of lumber, trees. Let's say I needed some trees. I needed some lumber. I wanted to build something. I want to build a new barn. Okay? Well, what do I have that I can share with them that would help them? Well, I have open land. Maybe they need land to store trees on, lumber, until they can go to the mill. Okay? Maybe they need to park their vehicles on my land. I have a few acres that are open. They could do that. Whatever it is that I have, my neighbor is my friend. I'm not going to be an adversary. I'm like, oh, we have to enter into negotiations. No, we sit down at the table and he says, I got these trees and you got that land. Let's figure out, okay, and there are royalties. Okay? And everybody gets some royalties. That's my expectation. The takeaway, royalties. Royalties. Anybody wants to come up with the negative, that's fine, but throw that in the negotiation if you're negotiating with somebody. If somebody wants to be an adversary, say, look, we don't have to be adversaries. We can share in royalties. What? We can share in royalties. Did you hear me? See, that's a shock to the system. Most people are used to the adversarial negotiations. I think Trump and Putin are smart enough and wise enough and have enough advisors, likewise, that are smart. And say, look, this all comes down to trade. This all comes down to GDP. This all comes down to sharing resources. There is no scarcity on the planet. There's abundance. It's only a question of how smart we are in utilizing God's created, God's given resources on this little blue ball, this little blue marble that's spinning through space, and it's all we got. How do we enter in as into a friendship relationship and forget about the old paradigms? That's my hope. That's my prayer for humanity. But I'm not naive, and neither are you. God bless you all.